stop. I don't want this.
I
want
to go in on the vaccine passport a little bit.
No, but I'm coming to this. I'm coming to this because you know that.
Yes, I do. You're a propagandist. Because you are. Yes, you are. Because you are appealing to the framework. You, because you're a snake. You're just like on the Gadsden flag. You know that if I can corner him into saying the vaccine passport, then the audience is going to get mad.
You know, I always say that everything is gay, cringe, and feminist, but obviously not everybody actually is. Certain people on the front lines of the culture war are actually fighting to instill the proper values and beliefs and the lifestyles that would make an American not only strong, but independent. Two of those people that have different perspectives and worldviews of actually how to arrive at that point are my guests today, Austin Peterson. So welcome to Slightly Offensive for the first time. So happy to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me, Elijah. And it's great to meet my partner, John Doyle, who I'm a huge fan of.
Yeah, well, me too. I'm the biggest fan of both of you guys. John Doyle from Heck Off Comedy, welcome back.
Thank you, both of you, for that warm introduction. I'm excited to get into some of this stuff.
You know, it's just really cool to have just talented, rich, amazing men that are good looking on the show, and we can just show the world that, you know, you two and your successful careers, you in radio, on media, and also, I don't know, little thing like running for the president of the United States.
Sure, I told him I almost dug out of my drawer my old AP for president shirt from back in 2016, back when I was a libertarian before, you know, I went through my enlightenment phase.
I remember seeing Heck Off Comedy and the little black and white intro that you did you were coming home to your wife, yes, and I thought to myself, this kid is going to make it big. He's going to go far because of how creative and talented he was. So I'm really excited to meet him.
I remember I did a video called, like, you know, three reasons why it's stupid to try to take AR-15s. And then he played some of it on his radio show. And people were DMing me, bro, Austin Peterson played your video on a show. And I was like, no. And I remember being up at like 2 a.m. trying to find like the recording of it on like SoundCloud. And I was like skimming every 5 seconds just to get that hit of dopamine. Like, he played the video.
Yes. Yeah. No, good content.
I felt the same way too. I was like, I remember I saw John's video for the first time and I was like, damn, this sixth grader is going somewhere. And then he came here and I was like, oh, he's 18. But then he moved here this year and he became 27. It was crazy. He's the first 18-year-old to turn 27 as next year. He aged significantly like fine wine or cheese. And I was like, everybody says that about John. Like, when did John go from a kid to a grown-ass man in like 6 months?
It was the beard. Because my roommate had a beard and he was like, you should try to grow one. And I was like, okay. And then I actually grew like a pretty solid one. A lot of guys, you know, sometimes you just can't grow
it. It's true. Yeah. I've kind of got like a little bit of Native American, I think, because it just kind of gets patchy. The mustache is strong, but then I end up looking like a 70s porn star and it just doesn't work.
Right.
Yeah. I'm somewhere in the middle where like I have a facial hair that's not bad, but it's not good.
Yeah.
It's like my entire face.
It's like your show.
Yeah. It's like the show.
The point is to try and reach the age where like when you're losing it on your head, you can grow it on your face.
That's true. And also to just make enough money. So if you lose it on your head, you can get
Elon
surgery.
Musked.
That's true. On that note, welcome back to Slightly Offensive. It's the best worst show on Blaze TV, where we always have 8K graphics, confetti of color. We're so excited to give the confetti of color, which is abbreviated COC, right in the face of Austin Peterson. Let's blast that. And on that, your wife, you just got married to Stephanie, beautiful, amazing, talented woman that married you. I mean, how'd you land that one?
So she found out about me when I ran for president, but when I ran for Senate, she came to Missouri and like was like my number one volunteer, and we were friends. And then after the Senate race, we went on a canoe trip and we went in this little cave. And at some point in the darkness of the cave, I felt this hand like reaching around, and like then all of a sudden I felt like this electricity, and it was like we went into the cave as friends and we came out as something else. And we started dating, and I think, you know, my boss asked me, he goes, Austin, what was the thing that made you realize that you loved her and had to marry her? And it was when I told her about my grandmother who had just passed away, made this special recipe of Danish noodles every year for our family. And she like, and I didn't think anything about it. And later she found out what the recipe was, made it and for my entire family. And I was so shocked. I was like, I cannot let this woman go. So I put a ring on it.
Wow. That's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And the whole cave story sounded kind of kinky, and I was getting turned on a little bit. I'll admit that I really was, and congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
Show that finger off. Where is it?
Thank you. There it is. So it's rose gold right there because her ring is rose gold, and to match her red hair.
So that is a nice story. And John still goes to bed alone.
Give me a break. I'm 21. I'll find. Don't
Dude,
worry.
Rad trad conservatives. Like, you should
I reject
be married,
that.
You should
See,
be
I
married
that.
At like 18.
That's such a not. No, that's not true. Like,
you should have been married at 9.
No, that is women. Maybe that's a joke. That's a joke. That's a joke. I'm trying to be inclusive to our Islamic members of the audience.
Yeah, inshallah, my brother. Anyway, on that note, before we jump in and talk about the actual debate and what we're going to get into, I got to tell you that there's one thing that we can all agree on, is that meat is epic. If you don't like meat, I don't really like you. But if you like meat, I like all types of it. I love, I like steak. I like sausages. Yes, it's okay as a man to like sausages, specifically hot sausages that are fresh and sent to you that are from a small farm. You know, as I've been reading recently about the way that food affects you and the weird additives that are in our food, I wanted to make sure I'm getting meat that's actually high quality and has a variety, like from bacon to salmon, etc. And I also don't want to support big food because they hate us, and I think a lot of their food gives us diseases and cancer, etc. So I want to support small farms, small business. It's very much my values, but also getting high quality meat products and fish, etc. to my door, which is why I got to tell you about Moink. So if you join the Moink movement today and go to moinkbox.com/offensive, that's moinkbox.com/offensive right now, and you get a free year of ground beef, which is pretty crazy because ground beef's pretty epic. I actually had my first time I made a ground beef ravioli. Have you ever had that? Deep fry ravioli with ground beef stuffed in it.
Oh yeah, that's a St. Louis thing for sure.
It's epic.
Yeah.
And you can get that free for a year if you sign up today. That's 1 year of the best ground beef. You can get anything from them, by the way. I like their ribeyes the best, and I like their Atlantic salmon, but get whatever meat you want. That's 1 year of the best ground beef that you'll ever taste. But for a limited time, go to moinkbox.com, moinkbox.com/offensive. That's moinkbox.com/offensive right now and get that free beef. Ah, oh, man. John loves free beef.
I wonder if any of the salmon I've ever eaten have been related. You ever wonder that?
To who?
Each other. Oh. Like, I eat one salmon, then like a year later I eat another salmon. What if they're the same?
Okay. All right. We're going to jump into this discussion. And I like to always jump into this by giving on these conservative TMZ type of intros here of letting the guests just get a quick 30-second to 2-minute explanation in the most simple way possible of what your worldview is. Because a lot of us are totally retarded. I'm one of these people where I don't think I fully understand libertarianism, and I don't fully understand conservatism. I just laugh at ugly people. And so but really, like, I'm not an intellectual at all. And I really enjoy people like you guys. And so for those that are not in the same boat as me, or even if they're an expert, as someone who's a libertarian, what is libertarianism?
The simplest way to describe it is economic freedom and personal liberty. So if communism places the role of the collective and the state above the individual, then a libertarian republic is a place where the individual is above the state. That the role of government, if it is to exist solely for the purpose of protecting the private property rights of individuals. And that having a system that protects individual rights, when you protect the individual, you're protecting the collective. That you don't get your rights because you're white or black or gay. You get your rights because you're an individual. And my personal view, I think that should apply including to the unborn, right, from that point of conception, continuing on until the point of your natural death. So as a libertarian, I consider myself someone who believes mostly in the primacy of the individual and that protecting individual liberty will protect the liberty of all of us.
Okay, so that's libertarianism. And I do have a question on that, though. Does that involve, like, libertarianism, that your rights come from God, or is it, like, where do your rights come from?
Well, Jefferson said God or nature's God, right? So he kind of left it open to the possibility that possibly it wasn't what the Christians define as the God of Abraham, right? So you could, in theory, develop a worldview of natural rights that was not dependent on a theistic worldview, right? And I don't have a theistic worldview. I look at our natural rights as something, you know, the more nature's God that Jefferson had discussed. Because I think the big questions of the universe, I don't know the answers to necessarily, but the things that we have found to be true, I think we can latch onto and we can claim as universals, and we should codify them in the Constitution as we did in the Bill of Rights. There are certain things that we know for certain, that life, liberty, and property should be protected, for things like speech and journalism and religion and the freedom to worship as you please and the freedom to defend your life and justly acquired property are universal truths. truths and things that we, you know, that we codified in the Constitution. So I don't know if there's a higher power. I don't know if those rights came from God. If I had to guess, I would say probably not, but I'm open to being convinced and changing my mind if enough evidence comes along.
I feel like libertarianism to me sounds like the gays talk about queer. Everyone's a little queer. Like, yeah. I feel like we're all a little libertarian in some ways.
Well, yeah, you'll find that a little bit. Yeah,
there's so a little bit of libertarianism. I relate to a bit of what you're saying here.
Sure, yeah, because there's no matter what the issue is, someone will say, well, I don't think the government should be telling people to do this or to do that. Now, they might say, well, but I do think that the government should get involved in telling you how to do this or that, right? What's interesting is that you'll find typically that people will have inconsistencies on those views. They'll say, okay, well, you know, I think that when it comes to taking ivermectin, for example, this was something like when I would have Republicans on my show, I would say, you know, we do have people in my city, my hometown, who are going to the store and buying the horse paste and eating the horse paste. You know, what do you think about that? And they will say, well, I believe in that they own their bodies and that they should be able to put into it what they please. And if they want to go down there and do that, that's their right. And I'm like, okay, then how come I can't go and smoke black tar heroin? Well, then all of a sudden it's, no, you don't. The state owns your body a little bit and can tell you what to do a little bit. Now, mind you, I don't recommend that you do that. But the either that fundamental principle applies, that you own your life and your body and should be able to do with it as you please, provided you harm no one else, or it shouldn't apply, right? So the question is the primacy of the individual, right? Do you truly believe in the concept of self-ownership, or does the state have some claim on your life?
Okay, and I'm not going to go into refutation or anything like that right now, but so that's obviously libertarianism. Now, you identify, this is like the political pronouns question. Like, right. who do you identify?
Caesar.
Yeah, so you obviously are Catholic, John. You yeah. are I would call you a staunch conservative, but maybe I don't have that right. What do you identify as, like, politically, and what is that defined as?
I simply call myself a conservative precisely because I tend to reject this sort of, like, leftist, like, you know, really getting particular with, you know, gender identity, things like that. I just say conservative, and I would argue that my particular strain of conservatism is the most authentic.
What is authentic conservatism?
Well, I will explain.
That's a big claim.
But I will back it up. I will say that I agree with basically everything that he just said, and I think there is a very real libertarian to conservative pipeline that exists. I think when people tend to start getting involved in politics, if they're predisposed towards right-wing thought, they kind of start off with this more like neoconservative, you know, George Bush, Mitt Romney type of understanding. And then they're like, wait a minute, no, libertarianism is correct. And what I think tends to happen, at least in my case and in all of my friends' cases, is that they realize that the broader coalition in which libertarianism is operating is not capable of actually cultivating what is necessary to return to that state. So, like, I supported him for president, for example, because I didn't get that impression from him. So I'm not saying you particularly, but like,
if you look at, like, were you able to vote?
No.
So I guess we all know why you didn't win then.
Right,
because could not vote.
All yes. my supporters were underage. Yeah.
Yeah, that is a very interesting thing. So it appears that also too, Rosenbaum's supporters, or at least the ones he supported, were underage as well.
Libertarians always having issues with the age of consent.
All right, let's not go there. It's actually a feebified.
Yeah, no, but I do want to talk about this because, you know, you were saying about this pipeline of libertarian to conservative. So obviously people that don't understand this stuff, believe it or not, the show can educate people. That's one of my promises, is that at least one time in the show, someone will learn something new. Yeah. So I don't understand this. I don't personally, like I always feel like conservatism and libertarianism are these, like, two separate segments or sectors of the right wing.
They can be.
But what I want to hear
John explain is, why does he feel as if his form of conservatism is the most traditional form?
Well, if you really broke it down philosophically, it would be what's referred to as, like, paleoconservatism. And I think you probably are more of, like, a paleo-libertarian.
I mean, not really. The thing is that, like,
reading Hoppe?
Yeah, no, not really. No, I don't jive with that, because the thing is that I have very open-minded social views mm-hmm. that don't really fit in with that paleoconservative. I'm not socially conservative.
Okay.
But because I am pro-life, people who are paleoconservative are kind of like, oh yeah, he's kind of one of us. And I'm kind of like, no, I'm not Catholic and I'm not religious and I don't agree with any, I'm just, because I don't think that the Christian baker should have to bake the cake doesn't mean that I agree with his social views. I would start up the gayest cake baking factory right next to him, and we would, you know, I would compete it against him in a capitalist economy, right?
Yeah.
But so people lump me in with that, but the only reason they do that is because I defend their rights. Mm-hmm. I defend the rights of people that I disagree with. And when you defend the rights of people that you disagree with, people think you are one of those people.
Right.
And that's one of the biggest sort of fallacies that there is.
So then what is paleoconservatism?
Authentic.
Your form.
So literally what happened, if you look at the timeline, is after World War II, there were a bunch of, and leading into, I guess, throughout the latter half of the 20th century, there were a bunch of disaffected liberals who were not exactly a fan of how progressive the left was becoming, and they were also not exactly a fan of the anti-war stance. And so they literally infiltrated like right-wing publications and media, and they were the neoconservatives,
correct,
the new conservatives. And they blacklisted systematically the more old right figures that you talk about. These would be people like Bob Taft from Ohio, or even into figures like Pat Buchanan. Those would be people who I would agree on like virtually all the issues, but who lost representation as these sort of like neocons usurped that power.
Brilliant.
So neoconservatives are basically just liberals who are, a little bit more hawkish on foreign policy and a little bit less willing to immediately go along with the social trends from the left, but there's always that, 10-year delay. Like even now you have the RNC announcing their first Pride Coalition, things like that. So
log cabin Republicans.
Yeah, that's why, which by the way, is that term was invented because of this gay myth, literally a gay myth that Abraham Lincoln was like this closeted homosexual. So when they were trying to pitch the concept of like, we need like some sort of like Republican gay caucus or something, they were like, well, we're going to write the historiography of the Civil War to be about equality and things like that. And so Abraham Lincoln, and so at first they wanted to call it, I think, the Lincoln Coalition, but there was like something else. So they called it the Log Cabin Republicans because there's this vague connection between.
It's weird we have the Lincoln Project, which is a bunch of pedos.
What is this gay myth of Abraham Lincoln? I thought that was confirmed that he was gay.
I have never
heard of this. I know you said the caucus, and that's got cock in it, but I don't know about Abraham Lincoln having cock in him.
No, and this is what's really like.
Was he gay?
No. No, he was not.
Are you sure?
I can't prove it. But this is the problem,
too.
Don't you think that like the whole Civil War was just like this kind of bitch fit that he was having? You know what I mean?
I think it was very feminine.
Him and General Lee were having a riff there.
Exactly.
Don't get me wrong. I do not like Abraham Lincoln, but
was the Civil War gay?
Yes, it was literally gay. The consequences,
gay rights.
The consequences of the Civil War could be argued
to
have
been.
The
next Civil War will be, though, for sure.
Yeah. It's just like a bunch of gay people with like rainbow dildos running around.
This is actually, we were talking about masculinity before we started recording. This is one of the problems when if you have generations of men who aren't masculine and sort of convicted in their principles, because in a long enough timeline, if you yield that power to people who are more feminine and more gay, they will humiliate formerly masculine generations of men by rewriting history books to say, oh, Abraham Lincoln was actually gay. Or, that we now have evidence that like this Viking warrior was actually like transgendered. Did you see that recently?
Sort of, but you're mostly wrong. And the reason why you're mostly wrong about that is because the people who created Western civilization, the Greeks, were mostly homosexual and homoerotic, and they saw women as deformed men. They were the very first misogynists, and they didn't like hanging out with women, and they thought women were lesser in society because they thought, and they had sexual relations with men because they saw them as superior
boys
women.
Too.
Their understanding of homosexuality, as I understand it, was basically that those relationships between older men and younger men were kind of natural.
What Milo Yiannopoulos got canceled for.
Exactly. But I think it was that their attitudes towards gay relationships between like adult men was actually like frowned upon. And it was only those more pederastic, I think, is the word that were like actually like idolized.
Hairless. I think that the Greek culture, once you grew a beard, that's what I read, is that it was either a beard or something. When you started getting facial hair, you were considered like no longer to be desirable, and you were to be a man and be inducted more into like a war society rather than at home taking care of domestic things.
So I think
it's like what it's called pederasty.
They would have been particularly intolerant of those, and they were, of those relationships between like gay adult men. It was specifically the relationships which were pedophilic in nature between the adult men and the younger men. But in terms of the libertarian to conservative pipeline, I think, like we said, we agree on like basically everything that he outlined.
So the Civil War is gay. Greeks were gay.
Yes. True. But
pipeline epic.
Were gay.
Basically, what I think it comes down to is a lot of what the broader libertarian coalition advocates for results in things that are not conducive to achieving the ends which they seek to achieve.
For example,
you're socially liberal. So I would make the argument that being socially liberal can lead to basically widespread societal decay. These people are now depressed and they're looking for something to invest themselves into or for a purpose, or even stripping, for example, national identity away through like an open borders policy, which like the mainstream libertarian platform, I believe, is in favor of. If you have this like big coalition of people where the only thing they have in common is that they have nothing in common and they're looking for despair, if you have a media apparatus that is serving as an adjacent propaganda arm to the state, they can then weaponize that against principles like that, because communists don't want everyone to be left alone. alone like you and I might. They would rather have the state come in and facilitate that onto people and impose, like, you know, their narratives and
the
agendas.
The problem,
on
though,
people.
Without it is that you must always adopt the attitude or the strategy or the techniques of your stated enemy, the communists, in order to fight against what you deem to
True.
Be the degeneracy.
Right.
So essentially what happens is that that's how you get the Mitt Romney 10 years behind the progressives' attitude, because essentially what the neoconservatives there are doing is they are adopting, you know, socialistic policies. Like, that's why you'll see Mitt Romney and others and Ivanka Trump and, to an extent, Donald Trump, progressive Republicans, adopting things like paid family child leave. You'll see Senator Josh Hawley adopting these policy positions. And, you know, yes, some of it is just craven vote grabbing, but part of it is, you know, again, because in order for us to compete what they believe, in order to compete with communism, we have to fight communism. And that was what Bill Buckley and the others said. Well, like with Ronald Reagan, the defense spending, when we had the nuclear arms race, for example, they said in order for us to destroy communism, we have to have massive government spending on our military in order for us to compete with them and to drive them into bankruptcy. But you either have to believe that communism doesn't work and will fail on its own, of its own accord, and that you don't need to intervene and have a neoconservative foreign policy, as the paleoconservatives I know don't agree with, and that communism will fail on its own, you know, or you adopt, again, this more libertarian view of foreign policy and a paleoconservative view of foreign policy. This is where libertarians and paleos coincide when it comes to the foreign policy. It's why a lot of libertarians like Donald Trump, because he had that more paleoconservative foreign policy of non-intervention, America first, and that is what I believe in, and I think that's why a lot of, you know, paleos and conservatives really liked me. But so the question is do you believe that communism is a system that works, that gets more powerful, and that we're going to have to adopt some of the strategies of communism in order to beat communism? Or do you believe that communism will fail of its own accord, and that we should be America first and only have policies and a foreign policy that benefits the citizens of the United States?
It's such a great question. The problem I think we have is that we're not combating communism on an international scale anymore. We're combating it domestically. And when we talk about the strategies of communism, I think there's a separation to be recognized between, you know, like you mentioned, combating communism by, you know, matching them in like a Cold War arms race versus combating them by wielding power the same way that they wielded against us. So the example I always give on my channel is that 100 years ago, if you were a communist, you couldn't get a job in academia, you couldn't get a job in media, you couldn't do any of that. And so what the left started doing in the 1950s and 60s was advocating sort of this like Trojan horse, well, we just want free speech. And so the well-meaning conservative man thought, oh, they want free speech, okay, I agree with that. And then they slowly had their long march through the institutions. And now the tables have virtually inverted to where if you're a right-leaning person, like you can't even say opinions on Twitter. I mean, I'm banned off Twitter, you got a 24-hour lockdown.
But was that McCarthyism then the original cancel culture? What we claim to be against?
I'm against it because they're canceling me. I'm not against it in principle. I think cancel culture is good when it's mobilized to cancel things that are bad. I would be totally happy with canceling communists who are working in this country, because to have that experiment where, you know, we can kind of smugly be like, communism doesn't work, told you, would require the complete destruction of our country, which is something I'm not willing to gamble with.
So you support the idea of, for example, like a boycott. Like, let's boycott a business that we don't agree with, right?
Yes.
But do you support using the government to shut down a business if it exhibits, degenerate principles, according to your idea?
It would depend on the degree to which those principles.
So my homosexual wedding cake baking shop.
No, I wouldn't do that. But what I would do are things that incentivize, and this is the problem with sort of amoral markets or capitalism for capitalism's sake. I think it incentivizes the commodification of vice, which I think will contribute to that deteriorative state of the country that we talked about earlier. So,
what is Thomas Sowell's quote, though? He says that, you know, if freedom means anything, it means the freedom to do things that other people disagree with.
I reject the concept of freedom for freedom's sake as well. Mm-hmm. I think that freedom is a means to an end and not an end in itself, which I think would be the distinction between our two worldviews. Mm-hmm. And this is back to the libertarian pipeline. So basically what happened is I realized, I saw a meme, and the meme was what snapped me out of the libertarian
phase. The meme, the powerful memes.
It was, no. It was,
it's like boobs and memes, yes. Two things that change a man's course in life.
It was a meme.
Three things, technically.
It was Pepe the Frog, and Pepe the Frog was about to be guillotined by an NPC. And the NPC said, any last words? And Pepe the Frog said, my principles. And then he got decapitated. And I kind of realized that to assume that we can maintain this power vacuum and cede ground to communists who literally want to genocide us and take over our entire country and destroy it is not an actual like practical strategy. And you have to use power for good and against the people that want to use it
but
for bad.
But private property rights give you the ability to exist in an order that is devoid of communism. If you own private property, and enough, certainly enough private property, you can isolate yourself away from those kind of people. But you have to instill a system of private property rights so that you can divorce yourself, so that, because what you're asking for is segregation. Essentially, you don't want to live in a social order that has communists,
right.
But you have to live in a social order that allows the freedom of communists to exist in a society where, sure, where they can proudly proclaim themselves as communists. They need to be able to have the free speech to proclaim that.
Yeah.
But if you have it, what you can't allow them to do is to capture the systems of government, centralize power, and to enforce their social order on others. And what we can't do is allow national socialists to instill their own social order in a way, because again, what we're really talking about here is the control of the plan, the central plan. That's the definition of socialism is central planning, right? And what we have to do is we have to have a disparate, more confederated type of a republic rather than a strong federated republic, so that we can have experimentation. And I think, yeah, we disagree with freedom for freedom's sake, but I mean, it's really, I think it's always the problem with conservatism is that it's always trying to solve the problem that we have right now, and it's never looking forward to the invisible hand that is creating the solutions that are coming in the future, such as social media banning and censorship that's coming on. I hear a lot of talk from conservatives about Facebook being a monopoly, but what's funny is that it's what has been revealed lately with the drops that have come from the Wall Street Journal is that Facebook is losing power. They're losing teenagers to TikTok. They're losing teenagers to Snapchat and all of their competitors. 5 to 10 years from now, the regulations that Senator Hawley or others or paleoconservatives would like to see on social media will be irrelevant. And then when the Democrats control the government, they'll use it to control networks like The Blaze. And they'll use those, they'll say, oh, well, this power, there's too much power that's being inserted because The Blaze wants to buy another network here or there. We'll say, no, let's use the antitrust laws that the Teddy Roosevelt Republicans passed to prevent Glenn Beck and Elijah Schaefer from capturing another radio station or taking, and they do that. That happens. It happened in Missouri with the network that I have right now, where the attorney general use antitrust laws to stop my bosses from purchasing other radio networks. So you have to be very careful, because when you use the power of government, when you create a new government power, you have to imagine that your enemies will use it in the future, and that technology will change the circumstances as well.
So the first thing I want to touch on is you mentioned like private property and being able to retreat away from that type of society. Mm-hmm. I think that almost presupposes that they would allow for that to happen because the central system has been created. Like look at Ruby Ridge, for example, or any of these situations, or even like in the USSR, there were people in like rural territories who wanted to basically be left alone and they were like genocided. I think that especially us as public figures, if this were ever to happen, like our names would be first on the list and there is no being left alone at that point. In terms of the kind of slippery slope creation of, you know, certain power, which will then be wielded against you. I think that the slope presupposes an angle, right? So like it's not so much a slippery slope that can kind of go towards the right or towards the left. It can get more right wing or more left wing. And so I think that because of what's happened in the last 60 years in this country, the Democrats are maybe one or two cycles away from consolidating basically a one-party state. You know, if they give amnesty and citizenship to people who can then vote, and just demographically speaking, like Republicans would never win another federal election again, things like that. So I don't know.
But is there a speed bump? And I think that you'll probably guess what it is when I start to give you more clues to it. Is there something that is unique about the United States within the borders of the United States that exists like nowhere else in the world that would prevent that kind of total consolidation of power, that would protect our rights more than anything?
Yes. However,
what is it?
It's the Second Amendment.
That's damn right. It's the Second Amendment.
I think the Second Amendment is
60% of all private gun ownership are in the hands of American citizens.
Right.
Because that is the ultimate bulwark against tyranny. I think it's even more than a speed bump. And again, when the police stand down, right? And my concern with conservatism has always been that it has a little bit too much trust in when you talk about authority in the police, that police will be on their side and the thin blue line aren't going to be the people who are going to come and take your guns away.
We agree with that.
Right. But ultimately, that last stand against tyranny will come in the form of the Second Amendment.
I reject that it will come, I think. I think the Second Amendment is basically a psyop in that it was written with good intentions. However, I think it now in the modern context kind of confuses explicit versus implied force or power. So I think that it would be a greater advantage for the state to allow us to keep our AR-15s because it gives us that sort of, you know, we have that safety switch in case anything ever happens, I can pop off. But it's like, I don't think that'll ever actually happen. And if it will happen, at what point? I mean, well, if the founding fathers came back.
What about the Bundy Ranch? What about the standoff of the Bundy Ranch when the feds, the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, showed up and they had rifles behind every blade of grass? They were pointed, sure, their guns at the feds. And what did the feds do? They backed off. Sure. That implied threat of force did work.
Yeah, in that particular case, though. But like, look at the last 2 years of American history. I mean, we have never, on the face of the world, with maybe a handful of exceptions in the 20th century, seen such a great display of tyranny. And we had all the guns and nobody did anything about it. And I think that is because the American man has become so demoralized and stripped of identity because of the consequences of liberalism and maybe libertarian thought infiltrating what used to be conservatism, has pacified him such that the only thing he really cares about is the fact that he has his Second Amendment. And that's kind of like his coping mechanism for like, well, one day I'm going to clear my neighborhood of the ATF. And it's like, maybe, but they don't even have a problem with killing you. They would kill you and raise the flag over your house just like they did in Waco or Ruby Ridge, and they would think it's a victory.
Yeah, you know, and obviously as we're listening to this and we continue to go on, whether you're in your car or you're running, or a lot of you have told me you like to listen to the show while you're exercising, you obviously need headphones to listen to this podcast in the best quality ever. How else are you going to listen to my Valley Girl voice and these epic dudes talking about things that most of us don't understand unless you have a pair of Raycon headphones? Now, Raycons obviously are amazing because they come in a variety of different colors. They're extremely concealable, so they're not weird and these little like long carrots hanging out. And I actually just lost my pair and I'm crying because you know why? They offer 8 hours of playtime and a 32-hour battery life, which is so epic when you're on those long flights and you're listening. Plus, the sound quality is the best for the price. There also is a built-in mic, and you can take calls on your earbuds at the press of a button. And again, you just simply click it, and then it's easy. It's not this weird, you know, thing that ends up getting activated without you trying to do it. These are very high-tech, amazing headphones that work well in all situations. A lot of you guys have bought these. You love them. So this holiday season, get them, get someone around you something that they can use for calls or music, work or play, or at home or on the go. Also, grab a pair for yourself, too, because honestly, they're a really, really great deal for what they cost, for the quality that you get. Trust me, you are honestly going to use them every single day. I use them so often, and they're so concealable. Like I said, I actually lost them the other day. So if you found my Raycon headphones, whoever that was that found them, congratulations. You just got an epic pair of headphones. Go to buyraycon.com/offensive today to unlock an exclusive deal up to 20% off your Raycon order. But hurry, this offer is available for a limited time only, and you don't want to miss it. That's buyraycon.com/offensive, buyraycon.com/offensive to unlock up to 20% off your Raycons. buyraycon.com/offensive. Check it out. Pick up a pair for yourself and a friend, and that's amazing.
So I got one more point that I wanted to get his thoughts on that. So with like the competing ideologies of the 20th century, liberal democracy, because we crushed fascism and, you know, communism, as we talked about, imploded on itself like a collapsing star. So it was sort of thought that liberal democracy was the final form of government, as articulated by Francis Fukuyama. I think he wrote that book, you know, The Last History, The Last Man or something. And so I think that for a liberal democratic, you know, nominally state to maintain that power, it can't be seen persecuting its political opposition as explicitly as was done in Nazi Germany or in Soviet Russia. So as articulated by people like Sam Francis in the 1990s, we'd have this concept of like anarcho-tyranny. So maybe the state wouldn't be going door knocking and taking guns, but it would allow for the forces who exist as like paramilitary wings of the state, be that Black Lives Matter or Antifa, to mobilize against the political opposition, and they just completely stand down, whether that's the FBI not even tracking their violence, or in Portland, they've ceded ground completely to allow Antifa types to beat up anybody who's to the right of Hillary Clinton. And then if somebody actually defends themselves against that using the Second Amendment right and our God-given right to self-defense, then you see that state power actually come down against them, like with Kyle Rittenhouse and what's happening right now.
What's the question?
So I guess the question would be,
do I think that's the final, that we are in the final form of government?
No, I guess it would be, do you acknowledge, or what would your prescription to that problem be, as opposed to the sort of framework that we've been in for the last few decades, where we always view the government as going to be the problem in terms of, like, you know, going door to door and confiscating guns directly, and that's going to be the stand against tyranny, as opposed to a more frog in the pan kind of professional tyranny where you have to defend yourself against the mob.
The mob is one thing, but I think the iteration that I think conservatives complain about the most in modern day are corporations. They'll say, you know, Amazon, for example, or BlackRock, you know, is buying up homes and you know, like setting up the value of the housing market to such to where, you know, individual purchasers can't get it, right? And, you know, I'm sure you would probably agree with me that most of these big corporations get handouts from government. You know, for example, in our small town during the pandemic, you know, when they were deciding which businesses were essential and which weren't, they shut down all the mom and pop businesses and they allowed Walmart to continue to operate.
Yeah, that made me I have to pause you there for a second because that made me so angry, seeing this weird, like almost fascistic, capitalist, communist mix where like businesses were shut down, but the businesses that were probably the most likely to spread COVID were still allowed to remain open. And then the government like giving priority to certain companies, telling people who were essential and who was not. I don't even know what that's called.
Well, that is fascism.
Yeah, it was really
this
weird.
This concept of corporatism, right? And the, you know, if you study like the rise to power of National Socialism in Germany at the turn of the 20th century, what you'll see is that, you know, that the definition of terms is one of the things that the National Socialists would use as a weapon in order to change people's perception of what it was that they were doing. So, for example, there was an airplane manufacturing company by the name of Junkers Airplane Manufacturing Company, and they were a private firm. And the government took over the Junkers aircraft company, and what they called it was privatization. Right. But what were they really doing? They were nationalizing. They were socializing. Right. And in many ways, what we're doing is we are nationalizing these companies. And it's this concept of too big to fail, for example, or picking the winners and the losers. Right. So, for example, during the 2007 financial crisis, you know, you had them bailing out Lehman Brothers and allowing Bear Stearns to fail. And right. And what was the difference between Lehman and Bear Stearns? They were both, you know, underwater and they were bankrupt. They weren't able to pay their bills. But with Lehman Brothers, you had the revolving door with the government. Right. And you had, you know, regulatory capture, essentially this concept of, you know, people who write the bill for Obamacare will go and work for the government. And they were working for, you know, they were the head of Pfizer at some time. And that is fascism, right? When you have crony, I don't like to call it crony capitalism because it's not capitalism, because capitalism is a separation of government and state, right? The idea that you can avoid the government and the state, that's what true capitalism means. But but cronyism, as we call it, that is the true concept of fascism. And that is what kind of separates National Socialism or fascism from communism to a degree, in the sense that instead of like with communism, you'd have like a government run car manufacturing company and the people who manufacture the cars are state employees. You would have the direction of production of the cars being done by a government official, but the people who work there are not government employees. And that's, you know, it's a difference, but it's like a distinction without a difference to it.
So fascism is bad?
Fascism is bad, right? But it's all forms of socialism. National socialism, democratic socialism, Marxist socialism, it's all central planning. And that's what we want to avoid. And my fear is that with the ideology that John is espousing is that it becomes more and more that idea of central control, that we need to have central control and central planning because people are too stupid to know what to do with their own freedoms. But I think if anything, the pandemic, more than anything, and a lot of writers who are paleoconservatives and who are, you know, more populist and MAGA types have written in the pages of the National Review as such. Michael Brendan Doherty is a good example of that, who's not a libertarian, has said that if anything, the pandemic has chastened their view of attacking libertarians and libertarianism, because the failures of the FDA and of the CDC at the beginning of the pandemic has proven that the government is incapable of managing an economy and managing public health. To me, the best argument for libertarianism should be the existence of Dr. Anthony Fauci. And the best argument for libertarianism should have been that the FDA's regulations at the beginning of the pandemic were preventing us from creating successful tests, and that in an anarchic way and in a libertarian way, private companies and private individuals in the science world were creating laboratory tests, defying the law as it was written and obeying the natural law and doing what they would do to help each other. Because I ultimately believe, and I think this is probably another difference here, that people are good, and that when left to their own devices, they will do the right thing, especially when we're in a crisis, including that time when it comes time to refresh the tree of liberty with the blood of patriots and tyrants.
Yeah, and I'm going to ask you something on this. And there was a video at the time this is airing, that was actually a couple of weeks ago, where Don Lemon. Yeah, I call him Mr. Lemon. He said something so ridiculous that we had discussed on You Are Here, where he was talking about the Rittenhouse case, and he was saying, well, imagine this, like if Rittenhouse wins, he literally said this, like it's going to show the right that you can just defend your own city, you can defend your own town, that you can defend your own state and your own property. Like this idea that these people genuinely believe that they're elitist, that they're in control, that the government has all the rights, and that the people you're subject to the government is there to not only harm you, but they're there to protect you, that, you know, you're not able to take control of your own life. And there's this like centralized, you know, I mean, obviously CNN is, you know, a state controlled media, but still there's this idea of like where they do see themselves almost in a fascistic or communist, some sort of a central planning way. Even today, even though we're a republic and we are supposedly free, these people still see themselves as the central planners for our thought process, for our life. And I did want to, that's why I wanted to pick your brain on this. because, oh my gosh, people are just retarded. And I when and you meet really stupid libertarians all the time, and you really meet stupid conservatives. You mentioned a few, like, oh, log cabin conservatism, and I'm sure you've met many mentally challenged.
Did you see the naked dancing guy on the stage in 2016?
No.
So that's what I'm saying.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
And I'm sure you meet a lot of people that are like, I'm libertarian, have no fundamental idea of what that means. They're not articulate. Yes. And both sides roast each other and are like, everyone's
libertarianism
stupid.
Means heroin to 5-year-olds.
Yeah, so this is where everyone goes in this. But, well, this is what I'm saying, but this is what I want to have this conversation, because this is interesting to me. You're talking about, like, the connection of the central planning, even if the ideologies are in some way different, the fundamental way they perform central planning might look different in action,
right.
But it's the same fundamental concept. I'm not outing you as an authoritarian, and I'm not saying you are. I'm not saying you are, but obviously you do, you and, this is why I've also talked to some other people that are paleos as well, do have this direction of, like, where it's too far gone. So the way that we have to, like, delete these people is through, like, matching fire with fire, force with force, yeah. Like using central planning and authority to combat this.
Yeah.
I'm not putting words in your mouth. I know how you guys think in that regard, but I don't understand then if he's saying, like, that it all ends the same in a bad way, why would it not end in a bad way?
Like the DeSantis example I brought up to you earlier. Right. For example, forcing the business to bake the cake or hire the anti-vaxxer.
And even that, you know, these are more like day-to-day things in terms of, because I agree with everything he just said about that central body existing, whether that's in terms of, you know, the corporations buying the state or the state buying the corporations, it's always going to end up with that central body. And so many people were able to understand why that's so problematic over the course of the last 18 months, 2 years because of that. The points of contention that I would have is, how do you make that go away? Because my prescription would be, you need to use the same tactics, not the same policies, but the same tactics in terms of canceling communists, getting them out of positions of power, not allowing for them to, you know, continue to march down the field under the guise of your principles, because that really would be the coin toss, is if you could occupy that central state, that's how you would, if it's possible to delete it, be able to delete it, assuming you had the right people in the position for it. The only other way I think you could get it to go away would be that sort of refreshing the Tree of Liberty. And then even that is kind of a coin toss in itself.
The Great Reset, but...
Right.
Second Amendment version.
I don't know that the right has the organization or the willpower to get something like that done, because
that's a big problem there. But yes. I mean, like, in terms of, like, fighting, I'm an ally, right? So in the sense, I'm with you in that we should
one
fight.
One struggle.
Right, right. I want to be a part of fighting back against the communists, right? And if we're talking about culture wars, like, this is what we're doing right here, right now, right? We're fighting the culture wars now. Like, we're doing it through media, right? Some people do it in other ways. But my question to you is that, you know, do you agree that the private business should be told by the governors of the states to hire the person that doesn't want to take a vaccine? So we're not talking about the federal government mandate. We're not talking about the authoritarianism of the Biden administration. What we're talking about here is specifically in relation to the concept of the 2016 debate with Gary Johnson, where I said that the baker should not be forced to bake the wedding cake for the gay couple, mm-hmm. not because I agree with him, but because I believe in his private property rights and his freedom of speech and his freedom of association, his freedom of religion. But what Ron DeSantis and what other governors are saying in this country are that private businesses, if you have, like, let's say a liberal bookstore like Portlandia, right, a feminist lesbian bookstore has 20 employees, and the owner of that feminist lesbian communist bookstore wants to require that their employees be vaccinated. Do you think that Governor DeSantis was correct in mandating that private business not be allowed to mandate that of their employees?
I do, and I think that he's correct because it oversimplifies the day-to-day operations of the business. So if DeSantis came in and said, you will bake the gay wedding cake, that means that business now has to use its resources to bake a gay wedding cake, and time has to be taken out to do something with which the business is in opposition. As opposed to, this person may or may not be vaccinated, it's their private medical decision, that's not going to affect the day-to-day operations of the business. Their job exists independently.
What about if it's polio or Ebola? And we're not talking about COVID-19.
Diseases that actually exist.
Yeah, we're talking, so in essence, so that would have to be some kind of a blanket concept. You may want to, like, you know, apply it to COVID because we all know that it's BS.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the concept of polio or when it comes to Ebola, there are people whose idea of libertarianism is that I have the right to cough diseases into your face,
yeah,
as long as I don't touch you with my physical form, right? Or there were people who at the beginning of the pandemic would walk into businesses and would cough on produce and actually spread COVID-19 deliberately. That is a violent attack, right?
Yes.
That is a violation of what even libertarians would call a non-aggression principle, right?
Yes.
So that is why I think that in the sense that the in the day-to-day operations, it would certainly throw a monkey wrench into their day-to-day operations if somebody came in with polio or with some other, deadly disease and says, well, I'm not going to get vaccinated against polio and I have a right to spread it to other people because Governor DeSantis says you can't require a vaccination in your private business.
But that does presuppose that COVID is actually a real thing that is deadly, which is the tricky part, because everybody that's shilling for the vaccine is not doing so because they're actually scared.
Correct.
It's because of the political implications,
correct,
which is why I think that's an important distinction to be drawn. So
true.
If the business were going to mandate, okay, if you're going to work here, you need to get a polio shot, then I'd be like, yeah, it's their business, because that's an actual thing. But because the political climate is so hot around COVID right now in particular, I would not want to cede that ground and concede that this is a legitimate thing. Because to concede as a Republican, especially an influential one like DeSantis, to have him concede that is something that they should be able to do, get vaccinated, that almost implies and justifies everything that's happened in the last 2 years, in that it assumes that this is actually a deadly disease, deadly enough to where if you're not vaccinated, you shouldn't even be allowed to work, which might put into the mind of the masses like, oh, maybe these lockdowns were actually
idea. But you would agree with the concept of mandatory vaccination in some degree. So for example, if you want to go to South America, mm-hmm, you have to have a certain mandatory vaccinations in order to travel across their national borders and their national sovereignty, right? So if immigrants want to come to the United States right now, and if they had an infectious disease and there was an immunization against that infectious disease, should they be required to be immunized against that infectious disease before they travel to the United States?
Yeah, depending on the disease.
So that's a vaccine passport.
Right.
So you're not against the concept of vaccine passports entirely?
No.
Just in regards to COVID specifically?
Correct.
Okay. Conservatives for vaccine passports.
See, but that's the thing. You're trying to corner me there and be like, I'm not gonna. Sure.
Because these are immigrants
coming from the third world. Yeah. They've brought back so many diseases that we no longer had to deal with in the Western world.
Yeah.
True, because largely because they're gross.
I don't want
so many diseases
or unvaxxed in my country. But I will say that it is funny though. I'm getting a kick out of this. I was texting my wife right now. I was laughing because I was like, it's funny to watch John actually talk to a smart person. Like, because John's always just like dunking on people. And then to see somebody who actually knows their stuff. And this is why I like you, actually, because I don't like libertarians. I don't. Because I do think that the most people that are libertarian are either A, they literally don't know anything and they don't claim to know anything. They're just like, I think I'm libertarian. Or B, they are like vegans where they have to tell you they're libertarian all the time and explain, I'm libertarian. And like, they make these most absurd claims, like you said, where it's like, well, technically a 5-year-old's still a person. And it's like, dude, stop. Stop it. Stop. I don't want this.
I want to go in on the vaccine passport a little bit.
No, but I'm coming to this.
Because, and you know that.
You're a propagandist because you are
appealing to the framework, because we hear this buzzword, vaccine passport.
Yes, I am.
You, because you're a snake. You're just like on the Gadsden flag. You know that if I can corner him into saying the vaccine passport, then the audience is going to get mad. I think that's true. And that was smart.
Yeah,
however, the vaccine passport was never anything that existed for things like, polio or even the flu. Like, you never had businesses, talking about, oh, we should get, or even countries. This is only for this modern context. So I think it's a little misleading.
But you believe in freedom of association, but only to an extent.
I guess.
Yeah.
But those are people who aren't American, right? So like my policies and my governance would only be over.
Are human rights universal, or are they confined to this geographic area?
They're universal, but you don't even believe in a God. So who would enforce that if not the American state?
Well, I'm not an anarchist either. So I believe in a minarchist constitutional republic, a limited government that's devoted only to protecting individual rights.
Over the American people, over whom it has sovereignty and governance.
Well, here's the thing. So the 14th Amendment, do you believe in the 14th Amendment or not?
More or less.
Okay, so we're talking about privileges and immunities. So in that, the 14th Amendment, they talk about within American jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
So once someone falls under American jurisdiction, which people do in places like Guantanamo Bay, for example, or once they cross a national border and they come under our jurisdiction, then they are entitled to privileges and immunities and equal rights and equal protections.
Yes. I
even if they're not Americans.
See, that's the point I would disagree with. agree with. I think that there should be some distinction there between people
but
who
you can't
are
kill them.
I'm not saying you should kill them. Right. I'm just saying that you could treat them differently, especially if they came from a part of the world that had a higher propensity towards these types of diseases that we had eradicated. Not even talking about COVID. At which point, I think that it would be totally justified to ask them.
There's a national security argument there, right? And that can become a blanket term and can become, you know, dangerous and problematic when we start talking about, you know, applying national security to whatever, you know, situation that it is. But there is a national security implication to immigration. And I do think that there do need to be immigration restrictions to a certain degree, right? I'm more laissez-faire than you possibly when it comes to immigration. But again, I'm not being an anarchist, right? I do believe that, like, you know, there have been examples in American history when our immigration policies have been better than others. And the best would have been the Ellis Island years, right? That, you know, the years, what's sad to me is that the greatest periods of American history are the most maligned by the left. The Gilded Age of the United States. The presidents of the United States that were the most conservative are the most maligned or the most forgotten. Calvin Coolidge, Grover Cleveland, and others, right? And until we can adopt a language of liberty, a common language of liberty on the right, we're going to continue to fight amongst ourselves when we should be fighting against, you know, we should have right unity against the communists and the socialists. There's a reason why I voted for Donald Trump, in part because I do think we needed to prevent a united front against what was happening with the left and the consolidation of power. There are plenty of libertarians. You say you hate most libertarians. There are plenty of libertarians who piss me off too. And the way that they treated Donald Trump in a way that was completely hypocritical, because all that matters really is policy. And when it came to Donald Trump, his policies were better. If they had voted for Donald Trump instead of Joe Jorgensen, we wouldn't have to be fighting over vaccine mandates, because there wouldn't have been an OSHA mandate, right? So yes, I do think that sometimes people make the perfect the enemy of the good, right? And that sometimes you're not going to get liberty exactly when you want it, right? But that you do need a good cohesive strategy to do it. But the most effective strategy is the one that the conservatives are the worst at. And now we have a bias because we work with the best of the best, right? Elijah, you are a star. You know, you've got a big fan base online as well, right? And the thing is, you're surrounded by people who are very good at media. You're surrounded by people who are good at fighting the culture wars. So you might sometimes be confused at thinking that conservatives are good at fighting the culture wars because you are good at fighting the culture wars. But for the most part, conservatives suck at fighting the culture wars. For the most part, we lose in Hollywood and we lose in television and we lose in the media to a large degree because we are not good at fighting the culture wars, because we don't defend, it's not that we don't defend our culture, but it's that we can't represent our culture in a way that that romanticizes it to an extent that people find it so uplifting that they want to be a part of it, right? We are in the 1980s, our culture was at its zenith, in my opinion, and the reason why we were so beloved overseas was because people loved Marty McFly and Back to the Future. They loved Ronald Reagan. They saw the United States as a great good, and yes, we had the great enemy, the great evil of the communist country, but we were very good at making our culture look excellent. And now that the left has taken control of our culture here in the United States, they are very good at making America look like an evil, terroristic, bad guy. And we, to some extent, we haven't even been fighting in their ground, because conservatives have been trying to stamp out libertarians as if we were responsible, as if too much freedom itself has been responsible for the rise of liberalism in the United States, and not stuffy, fat, chubby, bow-tied conservatives boring the shit out of everyone with their crappy patriotic specials and their saluting of the flag and their false patriotism wrapped in the flag, carrying the cross, that is the trappings of patriotism that is not true patriotism. And we're starting to see a new renaissance here. You know, again, you know, heck off commie and slightly offensive and what the Blaze is doing here are good examples of fighting back against the culture war. But that's the spearhead. But we need more.
There's like two, and I do want to bring this up. I want to discuss this further, because there's like, yeah, when you think of like conservative or right-leaning companies, that I would say Blaze is probably more becoming more libertarian, but was more conservative. But there's like two companies, right? So I mean, like, yeah. we're talking about like
Fox News. Yes, and
like
this.
You can like name them. And as we jump into this, I do want to discuss this, but I got to let you know this, that obviously, unfortunately, we do live in a society where even to rent a house, you do need a credit score. And a lot of people don't think the credit score is important. Wait until you figure out what happens if you try to use no credit. It's a trap system, but most of us, we don't know how to get our credit scores up. But you know, the average American has 97 points that they can add to their credit score and have no idea how to actually get those points. Well, let me tell you about this. ScoreMaster is the new credit science that super boosts your credit score. Forget raising your credit score a few points. That's weak. Be epic. The average Scoremaster user can actually raise their credit score 61 points in 20 days or less. That's right, 61 points. Scoremaster puts you in control of your finances, not the banks. And we know here at Slightly Offensive, we're not a big fan of the banks. So enroll in minutes and see how many plus points Scoremaster can add to your credit score. Right now, visit scoremaster.com/offense. That's scoremaster.com/offense. That's scoremaster.com/offense and find out how to add a lot of points to your credit score so you can refinance your house or anything. Remember, if you had used Scoremaster and you raised yourself just these points, you could save $100,000 over the life of your home loan. I think it's over $9,000 on a car loan. And also, like, if you're like me and you were stupid with money and you had student loans, I was able to refinance my loans from like 10% interest to like 2%. And I'm going to refinance them again. So yeah, it's important and it saves you money. Get out of debt. Fix your life, get into a house that you want or whatever it is, scoremaster.com/offense. So I want to bring this up. I need to bring this up. This is a little bit of a story time because you're talking about this debate. And a lot of people feel like me. I know they do because people have these really strong opinions of like where they lie politically. And that's why they're on shows, like you were saying, and they stand somewhere. Most people are trying to figure out what the hell they believe. They're waking up constantly. It feels like it's a nightmare that you never get out of, and just trying to understand like what's the way out of this shit. Like it's just, I know it's bad, and everyone says they have the solution, but it's none of it's working because it's getting progressively worse. So what do I do? And people are just wanting to kill people now. But if you're not, before you go and start killing people, let's see if there's another alternative. And this brings my road in politics. I started out as like, I would say more of like a centrist neoliberal type of person. I'm from LA. I'm not going to apologize for that. Got into the political world. Didn't even know my pants were skinny until I got on air. And then people in middle America are like, what are you doing? You know, like that kind of stuff. But I just, you know, just like just a LA boy. And I didn't even realize there was anything weird about that to like the rest of America. I was out of touch. I just was. I was busy. I was in college doing my thing. You know what I mean? Like I wasn't, I knew politics. I voted. I watched Alex Jones. Like, but I still wasn't like, I didn't know about the culture of politics. Then I go through and then I get brought into like this PragerU type conservatism, I guess, which is like, yeah, log cabin Republicans, every like, oh, black conservative. Wow. Black people can think, you know, like, and it's like, it's kind of racist when you think about it, that whole aspect. Like,
tokenism.
Yes, it is. So then there's that. And then I was like, dude, this like, I, like you said, then I would go to like, be around these people. And I'm like, these people are all talk. Like, these people are like, they're like, you know, we got to fight censorship. And it's like, what does that mean? Like these, you're not doing anything. Like, it's like, send me, buy my book, you know, so you can learn how we can all get along. And you're like, what the fuck are you talking about? So I started getting frustrated. Then I go and I'm like, who's the people who seem to really be willing to do things? I'm like, okay, there are these staunch conservatives over here that I don't know what they're doing, but they're angry. They're kind of racist. I kind of like them. And they're like, but like, meaning like they, but I meant like, I'm like, all right. But they also, they're so bad at PR. Like they're just assholes and like nobody likes them. Cause right. It's just like, they're just like, they're not just like angry at women. It's like, they're bitter at the world. And I get it though, but I like the bitterness. It's just like, they don't have their PR team needs to be rethought because everyone
hates
them.
You're conflating me with like that trad calf online.
I'm not saying you. I'm pointing over here, not you.
When I think trad calf, I think Doyle.
This is anti Doyle rhetoric.
But I'm not saying you.
I'm gonna remember that. You're gonna have to report to camps when I take power.
No, because you don't have a bad PR campaign. I'm trying to get you track
of
me here.
People love me. They love
yes, they do. The gays love him. The blacks love him. Everyone loves him. Women love him.
True.
And
the gay midgets.
Yeah, the gay midgets love you too. But what I meant is this. So there's that. I'm like, okay, these people like have pretty strong views that look like they could accomplish something, but they keep getting deleted offline and stuff. They don't even have any like route to accomplish their goals besides just being angry and having their groups. Then I see this side, like you said, like these libertarian people with guns that like taking over like a building. I'm like, oh shit, that's pretty cool too. Like, you know, a good example is like January 6th. You're like, these are like real libertarian type of like militia guys that like whether you disagree or agree with January 6th, they did something.
Yep.
And so I'm like, okay, so there's these groups of people, but obviously January 6th was a honeypot, a psyop, and that was
FBI
that
plot.
That was stupid too. So I'm just saying like on both sides. So I'm seeing these two people who are like, okay, maybe these people could do something. Like these real like base militia, libertarian, let's live independently. And then these like conservatives who are going, literally let's just delete these people that we hate. No, but like, that's what I saw. But it's like, I can't really get on board with either of these things, like I said, because it's like the execution and the PR campaigns are miserable. And so I'm sitting here going, like, people are like, so what do you identify as? So I with everyone and was like, oh, I'm a California conservative. I don't know what that means. It's a joke. But people took it too seriously. That's not, doesn't exist. Dude, nothing exists. This is all, we make all this shit up in our heads. And so I'm sitting here and this is genuinely my anger. So I'm bringing you here and I want you to, guys to both answer me. It's like, what is the way forward? Because I don't know what I don't even know what I believe anymore politically. Like, I don't know who to support. I don't know what to do. Because it's like Donald Trump was a colossal disappointment in the end of things. I liked him. I still like him. But it's like he's not going to move us forward in the way of that. Like, what's the way forward? What does someone like me who's going, look, I want to do something. I want to believe in something. But why is your way forward the way?
I think firstly, we should acknowledge that the fact that like he and I can have a discussion is like what the country should look like. And I don't mean that in terms of this sort of Dave Rubin, isn't it great that we can have conversations kind of idea? I mean it like conservatives are so often just begging for any sense of like inclusivity in the culture, not like inclusivity, you know, with a
fit in.
Yeah. And it's like, if we were actually having debates that were moving the country in the literally right direction, that's what this would look like. As opposed to now, we have debates where we're on the back foot with issues of like gender identity and things like that because we have lost so badly. Like if we were having debates about like right wing versus farther right wing or something, it'd be like, oh, I don't know if we should have 2-day shipping for M60s on Amazon. Well, I disagree. Like things like that. That would be so epic. But because we've been so impotent for the last 100 years, we can't actually have that because we, like you said, we don't really know like what the direction forward is. I just wanted to make that
well, but you know, and that's why, like, when you know, Senator Josh Hawley, for my criticisms of him, he does make good points when he talks about, you know, the attacks on masculinity and men retreating into pornography and video games and idleness and things like that, right? But it's not, the thing is that when you're attacking, like, you know, that, you know, people's form of entertainment, for example, you're not attacking the form of entertainment that is that our particular tribe happens to, you know, find the most entertaining. You know, is sitting on your butt watching a football game on a video screen as being as idle as playing a video game? I would actually argue that it's being more idle because you're not participating, whereas with a video game, you're actually participating. You might actually learn something that day, right? So, I mean, you know, we anesthetize ourselves as a culture and a society in many ways. And listen, everybody's got their form of entertainment and, you know, some forms of entertainment I think people can take too far. But I think pornography can be problematic for people, but it's probably a symptom of a larger disease. But when you're asking me a question about like things like what is the way forward, well, you can, can we look at something right now that, can we say right now that Bitcoin is successful? That in terms of like mainstream adoption, that at least we're on the verge of mainstream adoption, if not total mainstream adoption yet. You can't buy things on Amazon with Bitcoin yet, but the day that you can is going to be the biggest game changer ever, because Bitcoin is a libertarian institution and it was set up to avoid probably the most anti-libertarian institution in the world, which are the banks, right? And if there's one thing that paleos and libertarians agree on, it is the central control of the banking cartels in this country.
We hate them here too, slightly. We condemn them.
Our money monopoly that we have in the world with the central banks and the IDF and the global bank and the way that they load us up with debt and the way that they saddle us with it, that is the ultimate control. Money was not initially a creation of government. It was a creation of individuals who decided on mutual trade and voluntary interactions. And that is what Bitcoin does. It creates an end run. It creates an alternative institution that makes it so that, you know, if Joe Biden decides to monitor bank accounts of transactions that happen of $600 or above, and you don't operate within the banking system, you operate within a complete cryptocurrency design, well, then there is no way for the federal government to have access to it, especially if you keep your coins or your currency offline and you're not connected to the internet, right? So there is an institution that is operating today that is prepared to go mainstream, that does an end run against one of the biggest cartels in the world. And I think now that that our banking system here in the United States and the Federal Reserve Chair are screwing up big time in terms of protecting their own power, and I think that the reason why that our Federal Reserve Chair and our Treasury Secretary are saying we're not going to ban Bitcoin. Well, I think they're not going to ban it yet, but is only because of the foreign policy pressure of China, because China has banned cryptocurrency in their country and they've created a centralized cryptocurrency for their country. And because we've got a problem with them and because they made COVID-19 in a lab, thanks to Anthony Fauci and the taxpayer dollars that we sent to them, we don't want to be seen as doing what China is doing. And the money that we're making, like, for example, places like Texas, the Bitcoin businesses that are booming here that are coming from China are creating a stronger economy. And, you know, people aren't going to want to get rid of that money once it starts to come in. They want to tax it, they want to regulate it, but that money doesn't have to be taxed. And when I say it doesn't have to be taxed, yes, it has to be taxed because they're, you know, men with guns will come and take you away if you don't. But in theory, you and I can do business without having to actually have a third party involved and without having to have that transaction reported to the IRS, because the banks are the biggest snitches. The banks are the greatest enemies of freedom. And the reason the banks are the greatest enemy of freedom is because we have allowed the most socialistic, communistic form of central control over our money system to exist since 1913. And when I talk about the Gilded Age, when I talk about what the United States was at its greatest period in the late 1880s, they called it the era of robber barons, but it was the Gilded Age because we had a standard of currency that was backed by something of value, at least perceived value to the citizens at the time. And now we have a digital gold standard. And I think eventually that once it's the cat gets out of the bag and Americans realize that they can have that two-day shipping with a digital currency that they can acquire that accrues in value and that doesn't get reported to the bank, that's when the Federal Reserve, that's when the Treasury Secretary are going to try and look up for new regulations. That's when they're going to want to create a national digital currency. But if you're looking for a solution, the way forward, it's going to be an institution that doesn't involve the government being involved in a transaction, a voluntary transaction between two people. In my opinion, those kinds of institutions are the way forward. Finding a way to not be involved with the government and to be able to retreat from the system that the government places on us, having a private property system that is divorced from government is the way to freedom, in my opinion.
Right. You know what's interesting, though? I really like this. I'm a little bit like the volatility of crypto freaks me out a little bit. I'm being honest.
Sure.
Like, and people always love – again, that's why I freaking hate everyone's like – crypto's the best. And it's like, but they don't even really own any. Like, you know, like people always say this. I don't own a lot of crypto. I own several thousand dollars worth, but that's not a lot. But it's it does freak me out. But it's like you're right. Cause if, like, for instance, it's like if Blaze started paying in crypto, like their employees, if this was a system, it's like really, well, like even with like canceling people or like demonetizing people, it's like if the system that we start using is like people donate and sign up through crypto and like it's like you're kind of like just other than trying to fix a system or destroy it with fire, it's like you just, well, I have a new one and we're just leaving the system.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that you called out the banks because like people always use that as like, oh, the Jews. And it's like, okay, well, a lot of the families are Jewish, but not all of them are Jewish and not all of the banks are controlled by Jews. There's some. It's like really realistically speaking, you need to actually really figure out what's really going on, and it is the banks.
It's the banks. Everything traces back to the banks.
Yes, I'm saying, like, look at who funds the wars. Look at who's doing everything.
Both sides.
Right, that's what, yeah, the same war, both sides. And it's like, ethnicity aside or whatever people want to say, it's like you need to realize, and also I want to tell you guys who are pretty far right there, by overemphasizing the Jews all the time, you're playing into the bank plan because they want you to emphasize Jews because that's a racist. So that they can call you racist so they can delete you. So you're retarded. You just are. Like you don't understand optics and you don't understand like the reality of like where the real enemy is. It's like we need to take down the banks and I think they're too powerful to take down like by fighting because they actually control
the
armies.
And remember that many of the Austrian economists who were anti-central banks were Jews. The modern like Jewish thought leaders in the libertarian movement, you know, these are Jewish people who hated the central banks and hated the Federal Reserve. And those are the, you know, if you want to engage in tokenism, then, you know, you have those people there, right?
You know, but that's what I'm saying, though. I just want to genuinely say that to the people that really like spend their time overemphasizing things on Jews.
But this is pure populism, by the way. If you want to talk about the true form of populism, libertarian populism, it is the anti-central bank view that is the thing that could, in theory, unite the right. But you know what the big problem is? Is it's boring. It's one of those topics. It's not sexy, right? I think it's sexy, right? Talking about Andrew Jackson killing the second central bank, like Thomas Jefferson waging wars against Alexander Hamilton and George Washington to try and stop there being a first central bank. But I mean, like, why is it that this is not taught in our history class? Why is it that we don't learn about money? Why is it they don't teach us about investing in school, right? This is how you get a 1%, because you have a knowledge, you have a secret knowledge that is protected from young people here in the United States, and we do not teach them about how our banking system works. It is the biggest cartel in the world. It is the model of central control. It is a plank in the Communist Manifesto. It is the number one enemy of freedom. The Federal Reserve System is the number one enemy of freedom in the United States, and it's the one that people know the least about because it is the least interesting to them.
But it's intentional. Like when you start looking at what Wilson did and what happened and the way the country moved,
the creature from Jekyll Island.
Yeah, it all makes sense. And that's why I want to.
It is the conspiracy.
Yeah, and but it's real.
Yes, it is. It's not a theory. It's a conspiracy.
Yeah. Way forward, John.
And so the Fed? Are we all in the Fed here?
I'm
as though I don't have Ron Paul on my bookshelf. I gave a book presentation on that, actually. I remember it was so funny because my sister, she was a waitress at a Coney Island, and she got a text from a girl in my class who worked with her. And she was like, "Your brother." Everyone else got up and gave like a book presentation on like, you know, Harry Potter, Twilight. Your brother got up there and talked about a graph for 15 minutes, and it was the graph of the U.S. dollar value
the
from
value
1913.
Since 1913.
I was like, it's depreciated 95%. You guys are debt slaves. You don't even know. I was going like full schizophrenic. It was very good, but no one quite grasped it. But they will see. They will see that we are vindicated. I would
6.3% inflation in the last year. Thanks, yeah. Fed.
3% wage increase and 6.3% inflation. So we have. I'm just going to say that. Holy crap! I am not a poor person, but I do.
This is the third time he's talked about how much money he has on this episode.
No. And how rich we are.
Yeah,
I said I had several thousand dollars worth of crypto. That's not a boast. And also,
you are the 1%, Elijah.
Yeah, he starts off, he's like, we're all so handsome and rich
and
successful.
Elijah Schaefer, down with the central Schaefer.
Get him.
He's a Jew. Yeah, can I get a surname check on Schaefer, please?
Are you Jew, by the way?
Maybe. I might be, what was I, the matriarchal gay Jew? That's what people called me. What I was going to say is that like, most people watching the show, you're neither rich nor poor. You're probably just somewhere in the middle class. Probably most people. And this inflation hurts. Like I can feel it.
I married a Jew and she has an actual bag of gold and silver.
That's so funny.
John, I think it's funny. John, what kind of girls do you date, John?
Yeah.
I am all across the map. I do not discriminate.
I know. John just likes women.
And it's so true. And you give me a hard time.
If you
time
have
about
to say that.
Yeah.
Right? No, I have to say that John likes women.
Yeah. Then, no, I mean, he just likes all women. Because like people think that John's like this like racist guy that would like never like date a Jew. And like people just have these like understandings, like, you know, trad cat people. But John just likes hot women.
I reject the concept. I reject the concept of the trad cath being like applied to me, because even earlier, like I don't hate women. I understand them. You know, I'm sexist the same way a dentist understands teeth. I understand women. That's just like how that goes. But in terms of the way forward,
your confidence is admirable,
but it's true. It's literally
any man who says he understands women.
It's true, but I understand that they cannot be understood.
Okay.
That's the difference.
Well, that makes more sense. I would admit, I would say that I understand my
sister's fiance. I gave him the best piece of advice he says he's ever given, because he was blowing up my phone one day. Your sister, she did this, this, and this, and I was like, that's the problem. Do not contend with that which is retarded. You just do not push back. You're trying to fight gravity. Just accept it. You cannot contend against it. But way forward.
Yes, I was going to say literally. I think that we were talking about that on the show the other day, is like with women and stuff like that. Like I even just love on You Are Here, just saying blanket statements that are like hyperbole. You're laughing, but I do it to just like piss off my female co-host. Like just to start, like I was talking to my wife last night, and I was like, I really like this guy, Austin, because like, even though we probably fundamentally disagree on a lot, he's actually like very smart. And so like, it's like all in good nature. I said, you know, when you're talking to someone like really smart, like a smart guy, he's not, doesn't need to flex. He's just like, and he can laugh when you say retarded things, because it's like, it's just funny. Like he can get it. And I was like, I'm so excited for this debate, because John is also someone who's very smart, who says the funniest things too. That I make you guys crack me up, man. You guys are good. You guys are good.
Thank you.
I really do. I appreciate it. So what's the way forward?
Yeah. So what's the way forward, John?
I agree with everything you said about the fiat currency. I think that for right wing people, in terms of wielding political power, is to not confuse differences of opinion with irreparable differences in like the way forward. So like you and I had a disagreement about the 14th Amendment. We still agree on the Constitution, because the Constitution is supposed to be the framework from which we embark. We would never want to just completely throw it out and then go with something new, but that's what our political opposition now, the left wing, wants to do. So I would say that in order for us to survive, if there is to be a future, we need to make it so that people who are antithetical to the and this really is not that that gray. It's pretty clear, like when they want to completely throw out. I don't think people like that should be able to hold positions of power with taxpayer dollars and, you know, governments or media or anything like that. If they want to be in like, you know, like a private school and they want to hire somebody who's, you know, against the Constitution, that's fine. But I don't think things like that should be being taught in public schools. I don't think things like that should be being broadcast on like NPR. I don't think they should be allowed to like hold, frankly, positions of power in Congress if they're going to fight against literally what they're swearing an oath to uphold. So that's what I think, because, you know, we kind of get into these questions of national identity or, you know, human rights, and we're like, let's just agree to disagree. I don't think we can. You and I can agree to disagree because we're still kind of on the same page. But in terms of like literally where we're approaching the level of national divorce being like a mainstream topic, I don't think we can agree to disagree on like the very foundations of our country.
Physical removal, so to speak.
Deletion. You guys are putting, you're literally feds. You are putting that in my mouth, talking about refreshing the tree of liberty. And John wants to delete these people. I don't. I want to grill. They're the ones that don't want to grill.
They just wanted to grill. So if Kyle Rittenhouse is acquitted and he successfully used the Second Amendment to defend himself, doesn't that delete your earlier argument about it being a LARP? Because you were talking about the idea of the Second Amendment conceptually and defending yourself against the mob, and that people use this idea that they've got the AR-15 as like a LARP and it's not real. Mm-hmm. It's like that they're using that to sort of like anesthetize themselves against the tyranny that's happening to them every day. If Kyle is acquitted, doesn't that, you know, at this time, maybe when it comes out, he might have been. Doesn't that sort of negate your argument?
I don't think so, because what Kyle was fighting back against was literally an immediate threat right in front of him, which is a manifestation of tyranny. But in terms of tyranny as like a blanket term, like, you know, the government coming down on your businesses, saying you can't even leave your house because we're locked down, things like that, that's a much more implicit, though present, threat of tyranny that I don't believe was enough to wake people up to where they would want to use
their
Second
Amendment. But isn't liberal democracy just the mob? I mean, isn't that really
I don't like
what
liberal
it is?
Democracy.
I mean, that's what I'm saying, is that, like, you know, as we've, you know, created a more socialistic form of government as such as that we have, I mean, isn't like what, you know, Nancy Pelosi is doing with the, you know, the infrastructure bill in some sense, like really just destroying businesses, but just not with fire?
And that's exactly my point, is because it's not the explicit right in your face with a pistol to your head, we haven't been able to react and recognize it as that threat to where we would want to refresh that tree.
But I mean,
and I don't think it will ever reach
that
point.
But I think I disagree. I mean, you should see what happened in a place like Missouri, for example, when Joe Biden, you know, came out with his OSHA mandate, for example, and like our legislature in the state of Missouri immediately reacted. We're calling for a special session immediately. And the governor didn't grant that. However, you know, the legislature will be meeting soon. And I can see that, you know, and there were 8 attorneys general in this country who filed lawsuits to fight against that. We have private businesses in this country who are signing on to that lawsuit and are going through using the tools of liberal democracy to fight back. And ultimately, I think that the anti-democratic institutions of the court have always been and will always be and will remain to be the best protection of our individual liberty in the future, which is why, again, it was important to elect Donald Trump. I think we should have reelected him, and it was because of the Supreme Court more than anything.
Maybe we did.
Who are the best protectors of our rights.
Yeah, right.
Maybe we did. Who knows?
So that's interesting, because it was that use of like legal infrastructure and power that was able to help, and not the Second Amendment in that case.
True.
Because what we tend to see, and this is what I refer to when I talk about these LARPers, is, you know, anytime anything bad happens, their immediate instinct is, well, let's do something. And it's like, you're not going to do anything. You're just not. And so what actually was effective in that particular case that you mentioned was like mobilizing that political power against our enemies, which is my argument in terms of a way forward as far as, you know, the political institutions are concerned. Taking that power back from communists and trying to make sure they can never use it again.
Agreed.
To the degree that they have.
Can I say one last thing here? I'll tell you, the most effective political activism that I've ever done in terms of using the tools of liberal democracy was in 2009, when Congressman Ron Paul was calling for an audit of the Federal Reserve, and I was working at the Libertarian National Committee at the time, and what we did was we went and we wanted to get this bill passed through Congress, and we went and we had a petition, and we went and we got people who were registered voters in the districts of each of the Congress people, and we got thousands of petitions signed from people who were registered voters in their district, and then we walked, you know, us little young Americans, it wasn't Young Americans for Liberty, it was Students for Ron Paul at the time, and me, the Libertarian Party guy, went out there and we organized and we went to those congresspeople's doors and we knocked on the door and we came in and at the front desk, we said, here are the petitions. We want you to, your constituents want you to support the audit of the Federal Reserve. And they didn't have any, the congresspeople didn't have any friggin' clue. Yeah. They just knew that these were registered voters in their district. And then what happened? The bill passed the House of Representatives. Now, it was killed by Bernie Sanders, ironically enough, when it came to the Senate. But the fact remains is that boring political activism was effective and is what you're talking about here. But it's one of the things that I see when I was on Capitol Hill. I would see Democratic groups there. And I would see lobbyists there, but I would very, very rarely did I see conservatives with petitions. If you want to see like the most modern example of this, of successful conservative movements, watch the Phyllis Schlafly show, Mrs. America, that was on Hulu for quite some time, when the conservative women were fighting against the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1960s, yeah, the 1970s, because that was true political activism. That's exactly what you're talking about. And that is how, that is a true strategy for liberty, one that we're not using to our best extent here.
And it's like the point you made earlier about, you know, political activism kind of has to be sexy to achieve a mass appeal. There's nothing sexy about being cold. You know, I remember door knocking and phone banking. It's like very not sexy.
Correct.
Which is why something I try to pitch to my audience is like, you know, you are going to have to be very comfortable knowing that you're probably going to die before any of your results actually achieve some sort of tangible
impact. Such a black pill.
No. The sexy part is, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel. When we take power back in every major city, a big golden statue of Donald Trump is erected. Robert E. Lee erected. All the statues are restored. That's what you have to look forward to. You probably aren't going to, you know, see the results of that, because we kind of want to have this fantasy about a moment of mass awakening or something where finally we rise up and take back the country. But it's like, if you as a man do not even have the agency and inclination to door knock for an afternoon, do you think you're going to clear the suburbs of the ATF? Probably not.
I can say definitively that John Doyle is the true definition of conservatism.
Thank you. Caesar. You'll see.
You heard that from Austin Peterson. Ladies and gentlemen, Austin Peterson and John Doyle.
Wait a minute. Was that an insult?
No. You can find the links to their social media and where you can follow them in the description. And of course, if you make it this far in the podcast, I always like to say, I really do hope you enjoy it, because I don't know why you would be, I think, like an hour and 21 minutes into the show and you don't enjoy it. You got to figure out your life, dude. You got to figure that shit out. But if you do like it, then, hey, do me a favor and leave a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts. I don't think you leave a review on Spotify, but subscribe on Spotify, on Google Play, wherever you find podcasts. We are there, and you might get your review read on the show. But before we read those reviews, don't forget that it really supports us as we're demonetized everywhere. By eventually becoming an SOB, a slightly offensive backer, you can join the SOB chat on Telegram, or you can support us at blazetv.com/Elijah. And you also get access to literally like everything else on Blaze, including Crowder and stuff too. Crowder doesn't need any more money. Savannah needs a car. Sign up for the R code. Literally, that guy's rich.
Populist Elijah.
Yeah. Sign up
the
for
the 1% mobilizing Elijah against the 0.1%. Yeah,
Savannah, it's true. Savannah's not even mic'd today. She's here. She's a mic. But seriously, sign up and join. I'm going to read a couple of these reviews here. We got a review from Rare Female Simp. Says, I love this show. I don't remember how I found this show, but I have binge watched so many episodes. It's just so too funny. Sending mad love your way, and I'm so glad to have the show in my daily rotation of Louder with Crowder, as well as you are here. That's true. Get a lot of Elijah on like 8 shows a week here. It's a lot. It's a lot. We also have very satanic name here, 666 Halo. We don't like satanic-y stuff here, but we'll read your review because Savannah picked it. Thanks, brother. Excellent, excellent show for all the things logical, moral, and reverence for America and liberty. U.S. Pray, U.S. Awesome. Well, 666 Halo, we don't like that number. This has been another episode of Conservative TMZ, which is basically just right-leaning people talking about right shit. And because it is right. And that's what I want to take away from all this is the right side is called the right because it's correct. And there's a lot of different ways to view things. If you're like me, I just call myself hard right at this point because I just know I'm tangibly in the right. I'm just not entirely sure what that's called, but it's okay. And maybe you don't either. But if you want to know more about libertarianism and that, how that worldview, like not just talks about, but it's actually like affects commentary and a prescribed worldview about how the world goes, actually listen to my boy Austin Peterson's radio show, where they can find it where?
KWOS. You can listen to us streaming on KWOS.com, but we do a great live stream. It's the morning drive, 6 to 9 a.m. Central Time. The Facebook page is the KWOS Morning Show with Austin Peterson and John Marsh, and just on any social media, AP4 Liberty when I'm not banned.
Yeah, and to the youngest and newest contributor at Blaze TV.
True.
This you really are. I don't know. You might have announced it, but this is airing like a week and a half from now. So
yeah, officially contributor status. And nice. I'm gonna be autistic for a little bit, if you don't mind. It's kind of my trademark. A piece of trivia for the audience. The reason that we have left and right as the categorical terms is because after the French Revolution, which was one of the most disastrous things to ever happen in human history, in my opinion, was also satanic. After, you know, when they were in the building, it was the people who were the more conservative monarchist types who sat on the right, and the people who were the revolutionaries who were sitting on the left. So that's where we get those terms. But we're also correct. So that's kind of cool.
Okay. Well, John Doyle, who's, if you want to know what a conservatist or like a paleoconservatist conservatism worldview is.
Show my shirt,
yeah,
too.
That's his merch. Science is gay.
Buy my merch.
I like that. I believe, I agree
it's
with
true.
That.
It literally is true.
I worked in the field for a long time, but I think it's gay. But if you want to know what that actually looks like, again, to a prescribed worldview, then watch Heck Off Commie, which you can find regularly or as the plan whenever
so
it releases.
So regularly. Yeah, youtube.com/John Doyle. We have such an important video coming out, I believe, tomorrow. Wait a minute.
This is airing Thanksgiving week.
Oh, you've probably already watched it. Tell me I did a good job. Yes. I need that validation. If you want to maintain a healthy parasocial relationship between the two of us, you have to tell me I did a good job.
Yeah, and if you want to know more about what it feels like to just be clown-pilled and have no idea what the is going on, watch this show regularly because that's what we do. We just like, what the hell's happening here? So that's the show. And also don't forget to support Savannah at Rapid Fire Podcast as well. She's not on screen because she's like me and she rolled out of bed and put on a cap. And unlike men, women are embarrassed when that happens. Have a great rest of the week, guys, on the Best Worst Show on Blaze TV, Slightly Offensive. And may God bless the United States of America. I'm signing out.